Future CEOs, Big Brand CEO Thursdays.
So you want to be a CEO? Sure, go ahead, read your ABCs of managing book. Or if you really want to be a CEO, then keep on listening to this Future CEOs podcast with your host, Gareth Armstrong, as he gets you up close and personal with real-world CEOs, thought leaders, and industry experts to learn from their experiences and the insight and wisdom they've gained while leading in these challenging and ever-changing times. Are you ready? Then let's do this.
Hello and welcome to Future CEOs. My name is Gareth Armstrong. A short while ago, I had the pleasure of sitting with Anthony Farr, the CEO of the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation. Now, many of you may be familiar with the Alan Gray brand, which is a big player in the investment space, both here in South Africa and abroad. The Alan Gray Orbis Foundation is then the philanthropic and social investment arm of that organization. And they too are a very impressive organization and are engaged in giving back in a way that really speaks to the Alan Gray view of investing, which is looking at the big picture with long-term returns in mind. I really enjoyed this conversation. Anthony is a phenomenal individual, and I hope you take from it as much as I have. Here he is. Anthony Farr, CEO of the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation. Welcome to Future CEOs. Thanks for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So would you mind just giving us a little or a brief overview of what the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation does and maybe a little bit of how you got involved?
Sure. So the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation's mission is to create a future cohort of high-impact, responsible entrepreneurs for the future, for the common good of South Africa. We see the unacceptable levels of unemployment in this country, and our assessment of the response to that is to develop entrepreneurship. And I think everyone sees that as one of the answers to our challenges. But we've taken a slightly unusual approach to that, in that in typical Alan Gray style, we've taken a very long-term approach to this challenge and effectively are nurturing and growing these young future entrepreneurs from a very early stage. Some of our youngest beneficiaries we would identify at the end of primary school.
Oh, really? Okay.
Into high school. Our main program is at university. But even the university is just the first few years of a lifetime journey with these individuals, which includes developing their skills, their network, their capacity, their education through a whole suite of different interventions. And ultimately, there's a specially established fund that will be able to provide funding for viable business ideas that come out of this group. So we have just over 600 in this pipeline, and we really look forward to them changing the face of the country in the years to come.
Fantastic. Let me jump in here quickly. There are going to be some people that hear that, some of our listeners, and they think, wow, I'd really like to be involved. How do you go about with your selection process?
Excellent. So there are two selection points. The one is for the younger ones into high school. So they would be applying in their grade 6 year.
Okay.
And the applications are actually around about now. So they've got in any one year, it's basically around the end of September, end of October, that is the deadline for that scholarship application. And then what we call the Alan Gray Fellowship is at university. That happens earlier in the year. So the main people applying would be those in their matric year, and they would need to apply by the end of April of their matric year for this opportunity. And they can go on the website, alangrayorbis.org, and everything is there for them to look at.
Okay. Is it based generally, or are selections generally based around academic criteria, or is there a combination of elements that you look at?
Yeah, so both of those programs, the scholarship and the fellowship, are located in an educational context. So there has to be academic strength for these individuals to survive at really good high schools and
sure.
also to get through their university degrees. But it's not an academic award in the sense we are looking for future potential entrepreneurs. And so we have a number of criteria, 5 in fact, at the fellowship level, things like personal initiative, courageous commitment, achievement excellence, intellectual imagination. Those are the type of things that we're looking for. So it is a combination.
We're not really here to talk about the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation, though. We're actually here to talk about you and your journey. So let me kick off with an interesting question, and we've had some interesting answers to this question. And And so, Anthony, what does it take to be a CEO?
It's a great question. I think the reality is, as a CEO, you have overall responsibility for the entire organization that you're leading. So there needs to be a fundamental commitment and conviction to the cause of the business that you're working in, because it is going to take all of who you are. You know, I think I would subscribe to the notion of example leadership, and you know, so it's not just who you are 9 to 5; it's who you are as a person. And therefore there has to be a complete alignment with the organization that you're working at and the values that you hold, and so that's what it takes, is to really understand the extent of the commitment and the extent of the alignment that I think there needs to be between yourself and the organization, particularly if you're seeing yourself as an example leader, leader by example.
So you're talking about a values alignment. You're talking about an alignment perhaps of vision and aspirations. You're working for a very interesting organization. Can you talk us through some of your journey and the way your values developed and then how they align with the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation?
So I had a very traditional start in terms of my journey. Went to one of the good schools in Cape Town. Traveled a few hundred meters up the hill to UCT after that, and did a business science. At that stage was very interested in finance and accounting, and so qualified as a chartered accountant. And then the first few years post articles were at Standard Bank in London doing corporate finance. Okay. That was the career I was following. And I think my influence at that stage, to be honest, had come from family, particularly my father. He had been working at a big company, in fact, a shipping company, Saf Marine.
Okay, yes.
Ended up being listed through Rennie's, and he ended up being the CEO of that company. So I think there was an aspiration on my behalf to follow that path, and had a great role model in the way that he conducted himself with his business. But then something shifted quite dramatically in my case, in that I became increasingly aware of the orphan crisis in South Africa. And I happened to be seconded by Standard Bank back to Johannesburg, and during that time became aware of the extent of the orphan crisis in this country. And by visiting one of the local orphanages, left that afternoon just really convinced of two things. Firstly, I'd convinced myself before that it was very difficult for me as a merchant banker to get involved in this sort of issue. I wasn't a doctor, wasn't psychologically trained, but yet having interacted with the real coalface of this issue, the children themselves, realized that one could make a difference. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, just saw the extent of the challenge. How could South Africa be a great nation, which is what I was hoping to contribute towards, if 2 million children didn't know what it meant to have a mother or father? And so that led to a change into the philanthropic sector. Ultimately, with a group of other people, we launched an organization called the Starfish Foundation. And I suppose that in response to your question, I think for me, my work has to have meaning. And that doesn't mean that everyone needs to go into the philanthropic sector. I think there's meaning in every aspect of society. But my particular passion and need intersected around that particular issue at the time, the Starfish Foundation. And then, just to finish the story, a few years later, was approached by Mr. Gray, who I think was attracted by the combination of someone that had financial training in the area that he was comfortable in, as well as someone that had now spent the last few years in the social sector. And so he started to paint the vision of the foundation. And I found it to be a very compelling one, and was very excited to get involved.
It seems that a lot of the time people think that to be involved in this kind of area, the philanthropic area or even CSI type of careers, it's all about the fluff. But really what you've highlighted here is that there is definitely a need for not only trained professionals, but then also those who are trained in business to get involved. Have you seen Have you, in your career, as you have now pulled people into this foundation, into this organization, have you seen that that is a necessary skill that people should be trained on when they get involved in this kind of thing?
Yeah, I think, well, firstly, let's say that sometimes the distinction is a false one in terms of particularly the social sector and the business sector, because I think as we move forward increasingly when we look at issues of sustainability and the environment and all of those things, there's going to be a blurring of that distinction. So I think more and more that that is going to happen. In fact, and part of it is also realizing that my belief is that business should exist for a purpose, and that purpose should be more than just the profit that they're pursuing. Obviously, it has to be profitable, otherwise it's not going to exist. But
exactly.
And in fact, we have the Alan Gray Center for Values-Based Leadership, which is exactly that at UCT Graduate School of Business, which is about businesses pursuing purpose. But I think the main point is that if one uses that word fluff, there was a sense that the social sector might have been a second cousin in relative to business in terms, sure, of how they went about things. And my view is that those things are too important not to be done well. And therefore, there has to be a sense of excellence, a sense of professionalism in all aspects, whether it's business or social sector, because essentially we're all working in different ways and playing our own roles in building the country that we need in the future.
So you've transferred from being very technically orientated, Standard Bank and so on, moving into an area that, as you've described, sometimes is considered a second cousin, but really spearheading the movement into creating or creating a different perception around that. What are some mistakes that you have made as you have done that, and some of the lessons that you've learned on that journey from technical to really a leader in many, many ways?
In terms of mistakes, I think that the mistake that most people would reflect on most is about people. And so I think we all learn over time that we can't achieve much on our own, and it's really about building the right teams to achieve the goals that we're pursuing, finding people that are aligned to that goal, that have the skills and the passion to do that. And I think if I reflect on some of the biggest mistakes, it would be around bringing the wrong person into the team at the wrong time. And often you're aware of it at the time. There's a sense of something that is disconnected, and yet you convince yourself that this can work, and you push through and you reap the consequences. So I'd have to say that those people mistakes are probably the biggest ones that come to mind.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about appointing people? So there will be those who are in a position where they now are attempting to employ some individuals to grow their businesses perhaps, or departments. What are some of the key things for you in terms of employment and appointment?
Yeah, it's easy to be quite generic in a conversation like this. Clearly, there needs to be a base level of competence that they are suited to the role.
Sure.
But having said that, and again, it's almost a cliche, but I going back to the earlier comments on purpose, that you're really looking for someone that's aligned to the mission and the vision of the organization. I think more and more, if you read the literature around the nature of the employment relationship is changing. It's not so much the employee beholden to the organization. There's more of a partnership and alliance between the organization and the individual, and you're looking for that common ground, because actually, unless there is that commonality of purpose, you're not going to get the discretionary effort of that individual. And as we move into this hyper-competitive situation, if you're not accessing that discretionary effort of your team,
that extra
10% makes all the difference. So therefore, in terms of issues around employment, it really would be around finding that fit. Who is that person? What do they want to do? And does that align to the organization? And then lastly, the issue would be around character and teachability, that there's the right character, and also that they have a sense of self-awareness that will allow them to learn. I think if there's that teachability, I'd much rather support and back someone like that than someone who thinks they know something. You know, you're never going to learn something that you think you know already, and that's a great, great challenge.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Okay, thank you. That's a very good point. Let's ask this question. In your view, what don't leadership and management books teach about becoming or being a CEO? So many of our listeners are voracious readers. They really are trying to upskill themselves, but they're reading these books, and sometimes these books don't really guide us in the right direction. In your view, what aren't these books teaching?
I think the answer to that is really the reality that as much as an influence as the CEO has, you've really got to have created a context, a culture in the organization where everyone is aligned. And I think I've been surprised. You know, we have a very clear vision. We can set up very clear strategic objectives. You can have all of the stuff in place, but yet the misalignment happens very easily and very quickly. So I think the thing that maybe is missing in the academic or book world of leadership is just the complexity of life, and that actually if one's not talking to people the whole time, if there's not a constant reminder of actually what we're doing, why we're doing it, just little shifts in how things happen can have an incredible impact. I mean, one example from the foundation is that we're looking to grow these future entrepreneurs that have high impact. Obviously, leadership's a key component of that. We're also starting with them when they're very young. You know, we didn't want to kind of overplay the fact that if you're not an entrepreneur, you're kind of not good enough, as it were, because that will only be decided years in the future. So we're looking for your potential, but as a result of that, we started doing more and more stuff around leadership. And suddenly you kind of realize that there are actually people in our organization, despite what our ultimate goal was, that actually if you had to have a conversation with them, would be talking about growing leaders. And you know, that whole notion of actually the ultimate vision had kind of been diluted slightly. And I mean, that sounds like ridiculous. You know, how can that happen? But actually, it's just a small example of how just without that constant sense of alignment and realizing how the default is actually to drift, and there has to be such intentionality around, and almost it feels artificial in a sense in terms of keeping people aligned to exactly what you're trying to do.
No, I like that. There's a constant focus, a constant discipline, and constant reminder to individuals. As you said, there is a natural inclination towards drifting, sometimes toward innovation, which is a great word, or it's a nice buzzword. But when you're trying to achieve something as an organization, that's not always the way to go, especially when you have a very specific mandate or a very specific goal. Your biggest light bulb moment as you transitioned from being, again, technical to being a leader or a CEO, what was the biggest light bulb or aha moment for you?
I'd have to say that the biggest moment for me in that transition was realizing that, and this might sound obvious, but that I wouldn't be able to achieve and be as successful in that role without the guidance of mentors and other people. I think, you know, I initially thought that I could do it myself. I thought, you know, it's fine, you're committed, you're going to work very hard. And yet, I've realized that, you know, that if one takes that view and closes one's openness to advice and input from people, you're going to make mistakes that you could otherwise avoid. I think I was, you know, in terms of a light bulb moment, I came across a statement by an individual called Annie Stanley that says you will never realize your full potential without coaching and mentoring.
Okay,
and I think that struck home for me. And so I, you know, have at a peer level, I have a group of four or five other CEOs that we meet with monthly and discuss issues, both work and personal. And there are other individuals, sort of even international thought leaders around entrepreneurship, that I make a point of spending time with and coming to with with serious issues. I've mentioned my father already, Alan himself, just the opportunity to learn from him so consistently over the last few years has profoundly changed how I see things and how I do things. So,
in an interview I did a few days ago, the CEO that I was interviewing there, and he emphasized this point on an ongoing basis throughout the conversation. He said, you really are the average, I've heard it. Also, I've heard it say you're the sum of the five people that you spend the most time with. Yeah. I think that's what I'm hearing you say here as well.
Yeah. And I'm adding a sort of a vertical dimension to that.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so please finish the sentence for us. As a CEO, my highest priority every day is to ensure...
Again, it's maybe like your previous interview, it's going to sound the same, but I think the most important contribution that I can make on a daily basis is to ensure that everyone's on the same page around the vision and to be communicating that on a regular basis. That, you know, I think if, and I suppose maybe to extend that further, I think it's really kind of giving people clarity around how they are contributing to that, what if there are things that are preventing them from moving forward in that. So, you know, I think the highest priority in any particular day is to kind of move people the next step forward in terms of what we are trying to achieve in terms of the vision and make sure that there's absolute clarity around that. Mm-hmm. It sounds pretty mundane and simple, but that's at the end result that's what we, the organization's built to do.
No, certainly not mundane. I wouldn't use that word. I think that and even simple is not the right word, because it's not a simple process, but it's very pointed, and that's very important, that there is a very specific something that you do every day, and so yeah, thank you for sharing that. Anthony, what's the best advice you've ever received? So you've spoken about these mentors that you have, these relationships that you have. Maybe you've received a lot of good advice. What's the best advice you've ever received?
I think the best advice I've received would be around the importance of one's reputation and integrity. I think it's very seductive at times to look at doing things that will accelerate a particular aspect of growth, or that might be, and I think that's that well quoted statement around, you know, it takes a lifetime to build up a reputation and a moment to lose it, and I think that, but just to kind of have that front and center has been very helpful to me, and it's kind of something that in particularly in the younger years that you kind of don't fully appreciate, that you actually, in a sense, almost anything else is irrelevant compared to your reputation and your integrity and how you go about things. And a small example of that is, it was a number of years after being at the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation, having a discussion with Alan about, you know, why he had sort of made contact around the foundation. And one of the things he pointed out was that on the website, There was a listing of all the trustees of the Starfish Foundation, and there was, you know, some great people, and there were long lists of achievements and everything that the accolades had done. And he said that the reference, the biography for myself was just kind of two or three short lines, and he had been really struck by that in terms of just that. And I mean, one would never have imagined that something as sort of small as that would actually result in the greatest opportunity of my career.
Mm. No, that's a very, very important point. I think especially when we're young, we are trying to find our place in the world, certainly, and often we think that that needs to be, or our place needs to be found with accolades being shouted from rooftops and from mountaintops. But yeah, in this particular instance, that didn't get you. That didn't win the other people favors, and in fact, the other approach helped you. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. That's a very nice example. So, what one habit do you attribute your success to then?
I was really struck in the last few years by an approach to productivity called getting things done. Mm. I'm sure people are well aware of it. GTD, as it's sort of sometimes, David Allen is the kind of individual behind it. And and one of the key things that he talks about is that actually our brain is an incredible organ for creativity and for thinking, but it's actually it's incredibly badly designed as a repository and then a kind of a storer of information.
Okay.
And actually, the best thing you can do is get all that stuff out of your brain into a trusted system, so that you know that to-do list or all of the things that you need to do have been captured, and it just then gives your brain the freedom and the margin to kind of do what it's best designed to be, which is creative and so on. So
interesting.
And one of his sort of philosophies is in all of these things, it's really about crystallizing what's the next action. And so there can be an incredibly complex situation or project or strategy that one pursuing, and often that can be almost debilitating because you're kind of not sure what to do next. And you kind of also feel that you need to understand how the whole thing is going to unfold. And obviously there needs to be some sort of plan and those sorts of things. But there's incredible power in just identifying what's the next thing I'm going to do with this, what's the next thing I need to do with that, whether it's a phone call or whether it's just to write down a particular document or whatever it is. And I think getting into that habit over the last few years has, I think, really helped to remain consistent in one's effectiveness and productivity.
So do you keep a journal?
I do. I'm quite a big fan of Evernote. I don't know if you've
heard of Evernote. Yes.
It's just it's a virtual journal, but it's just you can throw everything in there, and it's kind of amazing. Kind of becomes very fertile for going back to different pieces of research you might have done or thoughts you might have had a few months ago, and to really kind of revisit that. And so that, and I think, what you're raising is that question of reflection. And I think that's, as you would have noted from my habit, that's almost what I would see is one of my weaknesses is not reflecting enough. So there's a more execution driven than kind of reflection, and you need both. And I need to remind myself more to be more reflective more often.
Okay, that's interesting. The CEO of Obami, which is a e-learning platform that's making headlines around the world, Barbara Mallinson, she's the CEO there. And you know, she said to me, because I asked, there's a question that we're going to get to, which is around books that we should be reading. And she said, you know, actually what you should be doing is you should be writing your own book. Because really what that does is it allows you time to reflect. It allows you time to look back and then also to look forward as you are progressing in your career, which is quite interesting as well. A nice thought.
Absolutely.
What are your three pillars of CEO leadership? If you were to bring it all down to three different things. You've mentioned some things that are probably going to come up again. But what would you say your three pillars are?
There are three aspects, and it's probably rather simplistic in a sense, but you can't get away from being the vision caster. You have to – people have to be excited about being in the organization. They have to feel that there's something that they are contributing to the world that no one else is doing. And the CEO – for right or wrong is the primary vision caster of that. And so I think that's a key pillar. And if that's not happening, I think it'll slowly wind down in terms of the impact of that particular organization, the growth.
May I jump in there and just interrogate that for a moment?
Please.
How do you go about instilling a vision within someone? Is it about storytelling? Is it about just going into a room and together working a vision document up together? What way do you prescribe doing that?
Yeah, I think the point is that it has to be done incredibly frequently. We'd spoken about before how easy it is for people to lose that sense. And so I think at a organizational level, it's important that there are regular opportunities, whether it's quarterly updates or at inductions, that the stories are told. You know, why does this organization exist? In our case, there's an amazing letter that Alan wrote in 1984 to the then finance department, basically offering 20% of Alan Gray at that time to support Black Enterprise. And it's kind of part of our history that there was, you know, way before any thoughts of broad-based economics way before apartheid was even finished. Here was Alan Gray Investment Council, as it was known, wanting to give 20% of its shareholding to black enterprise. So just as soon as you share that story, show the document, you kind of enter into a whole new space of that this is something that was always intended. It's not something that's been built out of compliance. It's something that really is at the heart of who Alan is and the contribution he wanted to make in the world from all those years ago. So it's those type of things. I think there are lots of opportunities, and I've been quite challenged recently that by the fact that if as a leader you don't have your a blog, you've lost the most powerful opportunity for sharing vision and understanding and getting the ethos of the organization together. And I initially rejected that. I thought that was just people that were more orientated to that sort of thing. But I'm having this year, for the first year, maintained a blog for this year, I'm beginning to understand that actually that's probably right, that it's an extraordinary powerful tool that many people neglect. And it feeds into the whole question of social media as another way of using it, and that wouldn't have existed even a few years ago. But if you can do that successfully, the opportunities that unlocks to share what the organization is actually about is extraordinary. And then I think it is just also the one-on-one time. I don't think there's a silver bullet for this. It's really kind of a consistent, multifaceted casting of the vision and keeping people excited as to actually this is something I really want to be a part of.
Lovely. So what I took from that is that you're going to be blogging about this conversation. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. But that's the first.
We've got it on record now.
Yeah, exactly. So that's your first pillar, vision, to be able to continually infuse the vision into the organization. When we say organization, really the people in the organization, really the lifeblood. Mm. Pillar number one, vision. Pillar number two and three?
Yeah. The pillar number two would be, it's not unrelated to vision, but it's about communication. And particularly as the organization becomes more complicated and larger, that communication is seen as a sort of a central competence almost of the CEO. It's not something that comes naturally to me, but the more there's sort of free flowing communication, that you've kind of created opportunities for that communication, for people to understand what other parts of the organization are involved in. We at times have been quite bad at that at the foundation, and so just to kind of really continue to create those opportunities for communication. And some of that communication is the vision piece, but other times it's just kind of what's happening, why things are happening, kind of just really, and the blog would probably sort of fall into both as well as another tool for that. So communication would be the second, and I think the last one would be back to our conversation around integrity. I think whatever you do or whatever you say, if it's not reflected by what you actually do, there's no way of overcoming that.
The quote that comes to mind is, "What you do speak so loudly, I can't hear the words you have to say."
Absolutely.
In your view, what should future CEOs be studying over and above their formal qualifications? So you'll get your BSc, your BCom, that kind of thing that perhaps many will be studying, and then there are those who are a little bit more advanced who will be pursuing maybe an MBA. Over and above that, though, what should they be studying to really be successful as they transition into a leadership role or into the role of a CEO?
I think they have to be almost insatiably curious. I think the level of and the rate at which things are changing at the moment just demands that they're basically almost the moment they leave the steps of the institution they've just graduated from, much of what they've learned is already out of date. So I would really suggest that I can't give a prescriptive answer in terms of it would be dependent on the sorts of industry that they're involved in and what their interests are, but that they would really be ferocious in their consumption of information around whatever area it would be, whether it's, again, the sort of blogs in that area, whether it's books that are particularly autobiographies. I think that the learning that can come from reading other people's story, there's many forms of mentorship. It doesn't have to be a physical coffee with someone once a month. It can be reading that person, someone that you've never met's book, and can have as much influence on you as a physical relationship.
Very nice.
And so I remember a conversation recently with another entrepreneur, and his comment was that it was at the time that Steve Jobs' autobiography came out. And he went as far as saying, and this was only like a few weeks after the book had been released.
Sure.
And his comment was, if there's, in this case, an entrepreneur out there that hasn't read that book by now, I'd question how serious they are about their pursuit of entrepreneurship. Because here you have a once in a lifetime opportunity of access to probably the greatest entrepreneur of the last few decades.
Mm-hmm.
And you're letting it sit on the shelf
and
not harnessing that for yourself. Mm. So I think, and obviously there's a whole new world that's opening up now with these free online courses, and I don't think you can overlearn in the way that things are changing, and because actually it's not, it's those sort of, when we spoke about that shift from technical understanding to more leadership and other things, and that technical understanding is becoming obsolete so quickly that you have to keep informing yourself of these other things.
Yeah, and what's interesting, and it comes up time and time again, vision of course comes up time and time again in these interviews that we're doing, and I don't know of any organization that sits you down and says, well, here are the ABCs of how to instill within an individual enthusiasm around a particular vision. I mean, it doesn't happen. So, as you say, there certainly must be this ongoing learning and multifaceted learning. Technical expertise is just one part of the puzzle. What books would you recommend future CEOs read? I know you've said, well, perhaps it really comes down to the individual's interests and so on, but what books have stood out for you? What books have really helped you? You've spoken about the Steve Jobs autobiography. Are there others?
Yeah, the base book I would recommend, and it's one that we basically ensure that every person entering the foundation reads and actually does there's a course attached to it, is the Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And I think it just, it's at a base level, but I think that those underlying principles are very hard to beat in terms of, again, it goes back to having your own personal mission, starting with the end in mind. It has the balance of your own sharpening the saw, making sure you're learning all of those things. So, just to us is the best packaging of that sort of human effectiveness. I'd really highly encourage that as a book. And then I think as a business or an organization, we've also been influenced by the work of Jim Collins. I suppose those are two obvious ones, but I think it's very difficult to move too far away from those principles of good to great, and that's really how we see the work that we do. That we have a very clear focus, and we just want to keep that flywheel spinning until it's having a level of impact that's difficult to imagine right now.
Okay, very nice. Those are great recommendations. Thank you. We're coming to the end of our conversation. Maybe just one or two more questions. And let's begin with this really interesting one. If you could go back in time and speak to the ambitious executive you, a 20-year-old, what would you say to yourself?
The message that I would have is to really, and I suppose the one-line summary of that message would be around focus. And I think if I had known more that there are just a couple of things that you just want to do absolutely brilliantly, there are a couple of areas that you want to focus in on and really have understanding about, I think that just saves so much wasted effort in terms of feeling that you've got to kind of have this sort of generic understanding of everything. And I think the more I see things, the more each one of us is crafted around certain things that we absolutely are designed to do and made for, and the more that we can firstly understand that, so that you can't, the challenge is you can't focus until you know who and what you are. So so maybe that would be the first piece of advice, is to kind of really dig deep in terms of understanding, you know, what's the contribution that you're going to make, but then to really be quite brutal around that focus. And it probably goes against what other people might think in terms of being, you know, being this all rounder and being kind of, but my advice to myself would have been, pick the one thing you want to hit as hard as possible and become the best in the world at that.
No, very nice. Are there any tools that you have used that you have found effective to do that, that you wouldn't mind sharing? Or maybe even an example from your life where you weren't as focused as you should have been and that cost you some time?
Yeah. Well, the first answer to the tools is to go back to I think Covey's a great place to start, because it kind of, you know, it forces you to get that personal mission statement up and running, to understand what your personal values are. I think that those sorts of tools, because again, it started from that very first question. It's really all of the stuff is an outworking of who you are, and if that's not understood, then you're tinkering on the surface. You're not actually changing things fundamentally.
And I think on the Jim Collins side, he's got something called the hedgehog concept.
Yes. Yeah.
Of course, that's three different things that come together, and at the epicenter, that's really what you probably should be focusing on, whether you like it or not. Which is also interesting. And then maybe an example from your life where there wasn't that focus and there was a little bit of maybe time cost.
I think maybe an example, it's probably not a great example, but just from the Starfish days, so I'd gone into that sector, and yet there was, you know, there's so much temptation actually then to, you know, I suppose it was a new industry. I'd kind of come out of banking and was now in a different sector, but you kind of are in attending a lot of conferences, or you're engaging with a lot of people around a lot of different things that are broadly related to the orphan crisis. But I think at that stage I didn't have a clear enough sense of you know what's the real contribution that can be made, that I want to become and understand better than anyone else. And I think it sort of manifested in a sense of even organizationally, Starfish didn't have as much clarity as it perhaps should have in terms of what particular programs it would or wouldn't support. It became a more generic, at that point, support of the orphans, rather than understanding what the kind of critical thing was.
Are you almost talking about focusing on a niche within a niche, if we could phrase it that way?
Yeah, I think it's just, I mean, and in this case, it is, I mean, I suppose what I've described is that, but that makes it sound more, you know, the point is that the social sector broadly around children is a universe in itself.
Absolutely.
So even though you could fool yourself quite easily that actually, well, that's what I'm focused on, the point is that is so broad, that you're not going to kind of get to a depth of understanding of a particular aspect. So it is a niche, but I think it's also, I suppose it's not to the extent of you actually, there's one tiny little thing that you do that sort of could become obsolescent in a year or two.
Okay, so, I hear what you're saying. All right, that's very important. Anthony Farr, the CEO of the Ellen Gray Orbis Foundation, it's been a really, really good conversation. Thank you for sharing with us. Are there any last words that you would like to share with our future CEOs community and listeners?
Well, firstly, I'd really want to commend all of you out there that are determined to make an impact, that you're really wanting to become the best of who you are. And I really, really want to encourage that. Our country needs the sort of leaders, the sort of skills that you've dreamed of creating for yourselves. My only advice is let your purpose be about something greater than yourself, particularly even this notion of a CEO. Don't even think about the title. Just think about how you can make the greatest impact. And you know, I think one of the biggest learnings that I've had over these last few years is that if the satisfaction, the reward that you get from pursuing something greater than yourself is infinitely more than the the benefit you'd ever get from something that was driven more purely by self-interest.
Anthony, thank you very much. It really has been a pleasure. And we wish you and the foundation all the best.
Thank you very much.
That was Anthony Farr, the CEO of the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation. If you would like to make contact with them, you can find their details on the summary page on our website. I'm Gareth Armstrong. I'll be with you again tomorrow.
Thanks for joining us today on Future CEOs. And we hope you're feeling inspired and ready to take action. Head over to future-ceos.com for show summaries, recaps, articles, and other resources aimed at fast-tracking your rise to CEO status. To make it even easier for you, simply sign up for our weekly newsletter, and we'll keep you up to date on all interviews, special guest appearances, new developments, and more.